B-Pod Studios.
This is Talkin' Rock.
Talkin' Rock.
Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Hey, it's been a busy week around here at the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Jack Blades from Night Ranger already this week. Sean Morgan from Seether. And today, Wendy Dio and Michael Jantz from the Rich Wrath Project 313. Honoring the memory of Gary Richrath, of course, from REO Speedwagon, who we lost in 2015. We'll talk with Michael and what they've got going on coming up here in just a few. But first, it's Wendy Dio. This new Ronnie James Dio memoir is out, Rainbow in the Dark. And, man, that's something I just got to get a hold of. I was on vacation. I got to admit, I didn't really have a chance to check it out. And so I kind of went into this interview kind of blind, not knowing what the book is about. I remember interviewing, was it Rob Helford over the wintertime? And they sent me an advanced copy of the book. I read it from front page to last page. Just great stuff. I wish I could have read this Ronnie James Dio book. I will, trust me, coming up in the future. I grew up a big, huge Ronnie James Dio fan, as I will tell Wendy coming up here in just a minute. We talk about a lot of things. Try to go through, chronologically through his history and whatnot. And Wendy was pretty cool to talk to. So without further ado, I will play the interview with Wendy. I started out by telling her about my upbringing in Western New York and being a huge fan of her late husband's. Thank you so much for the time, Wendy. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I was a big fan of Ronnie's growing up. And in the mid-80s, I grew up in Western New York. And in the mid-80s, I actually knew a guy who actually went to school with Ronnie. And he was the local guy that would come in. He was like a food inspector, health inspector at the bar I worked at. And he would come in and he'd bring clips of newspaper clippings and stuff from when he was in high school with Ronnie in mid-state New York.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, Ronnie played Detroit many, many times. One of his favorite cities, actually.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I know that I was talking to Johnny Kelly from Typo Negative. He said he saw him play here at Harpo's. Of course, I saw him many times here. But, man, it's so good. This book is out right now. And I guess my first question is, and by the way, you've probably answered some of these questions before, so I apologize in advance. But how much of the book was written before Ronnie passed away? And was there anything in there that maybe surprised you after he had passed that you read and were shocked by?
Well, he had written up to almost the end of Rainbow, but then when he was sick, he wrote lots of notes, scribbled notes and stuff on his computer and things that he wanted to talk about and to remember that that's what he wanted to talk about. And, well, that's how we kind of pieced the book together and, with Mick Wall, from the UK, who is a great friend of Ronnie's and journalist. And, we took also those notes and we also took, we went into the archives and found press clippings that Ronnie had been speaking about articles at that time, and that's how we put it all together. There wasn't anything that shocked me once Ronnie had passed, but before, of course, he would write a couple of chapters and then go on tour and then write a couple more chapters, but he always hand wrote them. So he'd bring them into the office and my assistant would type them up, so I'd be reading them then. So I was very shocked at one time when I was reading one of them about him stealing cars, because I never knew he did things like that. But he said, no, I borrowed them. I always took them back. So that was something that kind of shocked me. Most of the other things I knew about his life, but that was kind of shocking.
Yeah, now take me back for a second. Did you meet Ronnie at the end of Rainbow, or where did you guys meet?
I met Ronnie right when he first joined Rainbow. They had recorded the first album, but they had not yet toured.
Okay.
That was 1974, or 1975, four and five, somewhere in between there. And I was working at the Rainbow Bar and Grill. And Richie came in there, and we got invited to go to a party at Richie's house, and Richie introduced me to Ronnie. That's how I met him.
Yeah, and Ronnie, of course, now, was he still living in New York at the time, or had he moved to Los Angeles, or what was going on?
He was living in Los Angeles because he had joined the band Rainbow, and they were living in Malibu. They had apartments in Malibu that they were living at while they were recording, and I guess he was going to come back there when he finished the tour.
Okay. And then I didn't get a chance to read the book. I don't have it. I just came out, but I was on vacation. But I did read an excerpt of it, the one that was in Rolling Stone magazine. And you talked about how, he wasn't sure about joining Black Sabbath. And you said, well, we only have $800 in the bank account. Now, how did you guys not have more money after he was in Rainbow for all that time?
Well, in Rainbow, he got paid. We got a really big house to live in and a nice car, and $150 a week. So we didn't really have very much money. That was to buy food with and so on. So we never really got any money for it all the time we were in Rainbow. And when Ronnie left Rainbow, actually, my grandmother had left me around $50,000. And so we took that money and went to L.A. and rented places there. And that money had almost run out to the point where we only had $800 left. So,
yeah, I was kind of shocked to read that. It's like $800 for, you know, a pretty big rock star at the time. And, of course, he leaves Rainbow and he meets up with Tony Iommi, which was that that excerpt in Rolling Stone magazine was talking about. And how much stress do you think he was under at the time, you know, trying to find his next gig? He was thinking about going solo and that kind of stuff. Or did this just kind of come about and it was just like kind of a magical meeting?
It was a magical meeting. Ronnie was working with three different bands at the time when we came back from when we came back to LA. He was working with Skunk Baxter for a while. He was working with some other people, some people from his old band, McKinley Soul, and different people. And there was three different things he was working on and stuff, and that was just a chance magical meeting that happened.
Yeah. And did you know any of the Sabbath guys? You said he worked at the Rainbow and stuff. Did you know any of those guys?
No, I did not.
So what kind of rock stars did you know at the Rainbow growing up in the mid-70s?
Oh, well, the Zeppelin guys were always in there, the Who were in there, the Purple guys, you name it, they were all there. This was like Rainbow was the place to be in Hollywood at the time. And I was waiting on my green card, and so I was working at the Rainbow, and that's where I met Ronnie.
And so the Hollywood Vampires, Alice Cooper and all those guys always came in?
I don't remember Alice Cooper. I'm sure he did come in. I don't particularly remember him. Maybe I didn't serve his table. I used to serve the Zeppelin table and the Deep Purple table and the Who table.
Yeah, I guess Alice and those guys had some room upstairs or something. They used to call it Hollywood Vampires.
Oh, right, upstairs. Yeah, I didn't go up there. That was the evil den up there.
So what was it like for the first couple of years when Ronnie joins Black Sabbath?
Oh, it was exciting. It was very exciting. The first album, we went down to Miami, and they rented the Bee Gees house and recorded Heaven and Hell at the Bee Gees studio. And it was a lot of fun, and it was a very fun, great time. Really, everybody was really happy, having a good time.
Now, you don't know anything about my history, but I took over for a radio legend and do an afternoon drive 12 years ago here in Detroit. And I know what it's like to step into someone's shoes, and it took me a little while to kind of figure out that this was my shift and this was, you know, my time. Did it take Ronnie a little bit of time, or did he just go about and do his thing and just do his own Black Sabbath?
I think in the beginning it was a big boots to fill from Ozzy, you know. I mean, Ozzy was Sabbath as far as the fans were concerned. And Ronnie, first of all, I mean, he was very nervous about it. I think he got booed a few shows, maybe spat on or whatever. But I think that the kids suddenly realized the music was good, and they accepted him. And of course he, you know, did the Maloik sign, which, you know, Ozzy was always known for the peace sign. And Ronnie had grown up with his old grandma going when he was about 5 or 6. He would walk with his grandma to the steel mill where his grandpa worked to give him his lunch. And she would always be doing this sign, which was the Maloik, you know, which is thousands and thousands of years old Italian sign to ward off evil. A lot of people think it's a devil sign, but actually ward off evil. And it just came to him, I guess, one day. He just flipped it, and that was it. And then it became popularized.
Yeah, that's, of course. I mean, you know, I saw Dio, I should say, back in, I think, 86 or 87, something like that. I remember seeing him on that tour, and that was the earliest I ever saw him. So then he goes through Black Sabbath, and he decides to leave the band, and I read about that as well. That was kind of like some sort of, I don't know, there was something about he was maybe, accused of fiddling with the levels as far as a live recording was concerned or something.
Well, I think that everybody was doing a lot of drugs, and there was a lot of paranoia going on at the time. I don't think Ronnie ever did that. He would never do that. But he got accused of that. It was just, it was time for him to leave.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was thinking the exact same thing. I only met Ronnie once, and I'd say this, you know, not just because you're on the phone. He was one of the nicest guys I ever met in this business, and he made me feel welcome. This is 26, 27 years ago, and, you know, I'm thinking to myself, I read that. I'm like, that doesn't sound like that guy, even though I only met him for 10 or 15 minutes. But anyway, so then he goes off and does his solo thing, which he was kind of thinking of doing before Black Sabbath. So was that kind of always in the back of his mind anyways?
No, he got a solo deal, but I think it was just something that he wanted to do somewhere in between. I don't think he ever wanted to leave Black Sabbath. He was just that he had the solo deal, and it was something that, you know, down the line he would think about, but not anything he was really pressured into doing until he decided to leave Sabbath.
And do you think that the, I mean, really the popularity and really those excellent albums from Black Sabbath gave him a little more confidence just to go out and do it on his own?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I know that I interviewed Vivian Campbell a few years ago, and he said something about Ronnie's, you know, he's looked at him like maybe like his own personal Randy Rhoads. And he told me that, you know, that perhaps if Ronnie would have lived, that they might have bumped into each other and eventually would have made up and stuff like that. He told me this big, I mean, he really poured his heart out to me a couple years ago about this. Do you think that's true?
I have no idea. Yeah. You'd have to ask Ronnie that. I don't know.
Yeah. So then he goes and he does this solo stuff. Those albums were, I mean, just friggin' awesome. And he really gains a lot of popularity during the 1980s and stuff. I wanted to ask you about what he thought about when the 1990s hits and the grunge scene comes in. I saw him in 1992 on that Sabbath tour. I believe it was 1992. And what was his thoughts on some of the new music coming out of Seattle?
Well, it was a very bad time for us at the time. We got dropped from the record label. Van Halen got dropped. Everybody got dropped because grunge came in and metal was out. It was a hard time. We had to go find, you know, new labels and independent labels that had always been on major labels. Considering grunge music, Ronnie loved music. He loved all music. He says there's never any bad music. Someone created it, and it's all good music. So I think the grunge, he liked the grunge music, but it was a very hard time for all of us. Any metal people, it was a very hard time for all of them.
Yeah, no doubt. And then somebody asked me on my Facebook, because I told him I was gonna be talking to you, like, what kind of stuff would he listen to when he was at home? Was it something we'd be surprised about?
He'd listen to a lot of classical music, Bach, Beethoven. He loved Beethoven, which Beethoven was like the rock star in his day with his loud boom, boom music and everything. I listened to that. He listened to new young bands that were coming up he'd like to listen to. You know, he just would listen. He mostly watched TV and write music to watch in sports. He loved to take his acoustic guitar and sit on the couch and write songs while he watched sports.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So I was watching this, speaking of watching TV, I just happened to rewatch this a few weeks ago, but what that Tenacious D movie, The Pick of Destiny, is so great, and Ronnie plays such like a prominent role in that. What was his thoughts on like the kind of the pop and the cultural icon he'd become?
Oh, he loved Jack Black. He loved him. They had such great humor together. They were, and Jack was always really funny. Jack's a great, I mean, he's always been so gracious to me. Every time we've done some charity, he's always there to give his, you know, his time and his talent. But they just got on really, really well. It started, I think, when they put out Pass the Torch, and it was kind of making fun of Ronnie, and Ronnie thought that was really hysterical, and then Jack did a video with Ronnie for the album, for the song Push. Then they just developed this friendship, and then Jack asked him to be in his movie, and that was just a real fun time.
Yeah, that movie's so funny. Like I said, I don't know why. I think it was a rainy day or something, and I always liked that movie, and of course, you know, with Ronnie in it and stuff. it's just so much fun. But so what was his relationship like when he passed away with Ritchie Blackmore? Did he talk to Ritchie at all?
No, that was
done. Yeah, that's what I thought, because I've talked to some of Ritchie's former bandmates, and it kind of seems like everybody's like that. But somebody wanted to ask me. They said that Ripper Owens, that we saw his show here a couple of months ago, and I guess you and him are friends.
Oh, absolutely. I do a lot of stuff. Well, he was playing with the Dio Band. when we went out all the time. No, we are very, very good friends. I'm very good friends with him and his kids. But he's now with KK. So he's joined KK's Judas Priest. And he's often doing that, and I'm very happy for him. We talk all the time. He actually comes out with his kids and stays with me sometimes.
No, that's great. You know, speaking of that, it's like I was thinking about this on the way into work today. I can't think of another artist that has passed on who has, you know, tribute bands as powerful as, you know, Last in Line and Dio's Disciples. What are your thoughts about those bands?
Well, I think it's great. It's, any tribute band is keeping Ronnie's music and his legends alive, and I'm very happy about that. Absolutely.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there's like tribute bands out there of just guys, but there are those are like high-powered tribute bands with guys that were actually playing with Ronnie. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, they want to keep the music alive, and they play tribute to Ronnie. They loved Ronnie. You know, they all loved Ronnie. So it's fun for them to be out there and keeping his music alive and playing the music that they love to play.
Somebody on my Facebook wanted to know what your favorite era of Dio is musically.
Oh, God, that's a very hard question. Well, I mean, at the times, they were all really great times. I don't know. I think with the Dio band, obviously, it was his own band and things. But I was really, really happy that he got to go back with Sabbath at the end, just before he passed away. That was, to me, it was like the end of the book. It was a circle that had been fulfilled. And he was so happy with the guys. Everybody was straight. Nobody was doing drugs. Everybody was playing amazingly, absolutely amazingly. I mean, Tony Iommi was always called him the riff master. And, you know, Geezer Butler, a great bass player, and Vinny, the great drummer. And he was having such a good time with them. So I have to say that I was so happy to see that happen.
Yeah, kind of come full circle for sure. So you were talking earlier about how the book was kind of written by Ronnie up until the end of Rainbow. So you said that you had to like interview clips and different, you know, stuff like that. But did you ever reach out to any of these other guys to get stories and stuff to maybe straighten up some loose ends as far as the stories are concerned?
Well, the book doesn't really, it's different. It's not the usual book where it's just Ronnie's life. It doesn't go into like talking to other band members or things like that. That is in the documentary, which is coming out next year. But the book is just carries on with what was going on actually in Ronnie's life with that. And obviously I know all the band. I mean, I know Simon so well and you know, and Rudy and all, I mean, I know Jimmy real well before he passed, and all these people, I know them real well. So I know all the stories and all the things that Ronnie wanted to say.
And you just mentioned a documentary. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm not supposed to talk about it, but I'm going to see the first clip of it actually next week. And it should be coming out next year. And lots and lots and lots of people with stars of all, everybody's involved in it, who are all in there talking about Ronnie and showing different clips and different times, all going through his whole life. And I'm very interested to see what's come of it.
And this is going to be something streaming or something like that?
I think it's going, well, we're hoping to take it to Sundance. I don't know if we'll be able to, but we're hoping that.
Yeah. No, those rock documentaries are so great. And I like watching, you know, those kind of things at home with my kids especially, too. But sometimes it helps to revive careers as well, like you've seen with, like, well, it's not really a documentary, but the Queen one did, you know, magic for those guys.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, that was really good. I really enjoyed that. But that's more of a biopsy.
Yeah. Let's see here. Somebody asked, what was Ronnie most proud of being a part of and maybe biggest regret? Would you know of anything like that?
Biggest regret? Let me think. Not being able to be a baseball player. This is what his dream was in the beginning. I don't know. Biggest regret. I'm trying to think what would be the biggest regret. I don't know. Probably that. I mean, Ronnie was in content with his life. We went through ups and downs, and I think the book is trying to portray that, you know, never give up, because if you keep on follow your dream, that you will succeed. Because the book goes through all the trials and tribulations he had with the bands. I mean, he had a band when he was, I think, 10 years old, his first band, and going through life with that. But I don't know if there was any regrets. Maybe regretting smashing his dad's car up. Maybe that. I don't know.
So obviously he sang for Rainbow and he sang for Sabbath and all stuff. Did he ever audition, or did any other bands try to get him to play?
No. He auditioned for a couple of movies that he didn't get.
Oh, is that?
A couple of movies that he didn't get.
Oh, is that?
A couple of movies that he didn't get.
Oh, is that?
A couple of movies that he didn't get.
Oh, is that right? Who wouldn't want Ronnie James Dio in their movie? Were there any movies we would have heard of?
No, there weren't movies of him. It was movies of him playing a part. That was early on in his career.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I'm 5'6". I know I was a couple inches taller than Ronnie when he stood up and gave me a hug one time and thanked me for showing up. And you know, I know it's so funny because I look at some of those older pictures and Ronnie's, you know, standing up in the front and stuff. And I know the feeling, man. Whenever I'm in pictures, it's like, man, everybody's taller than me.
Yeah. Well, he's actually 5'4½". You left off half an inch, which he'd be very unhappy to hear.
You know, he told Lizzie Hale's a friend of mine, and maybe, I don't know if you can comment on this or not, but, you know, I told her one time that Ronnie was so nice, and she's so nice as well, and she told me that Ronnie told her that the fans will always remember you, and even though you may not remember their names or faces or where they met, always make every fan feel special. That's kind of how he was, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He loved his fans. He loved the fans. He never, ever forgot where he came from. He did everything for the fans. They were the most important thing for him, because he said, I wouldn't have what I have if it wasn't for them. And he really meant it. He really spent time with them. I mean, they are standing there waiting for an audition, for an autograph for so many hours. You know, why should I disappoint them? And, you know, he generally loved people. He loved to talk to people. And he would make anyone that he talked to feel very special. And that, he had a gift for that. And that's a very special thing that he had.
Did he enjoy going to places? I have some famous friends, you know, and they kind of enjoy going to places, especially during this COVID with their mascot and no one knows who they are. But did he enjoy going places where he wasn't recognized?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, him and Geeta Butler were planning on going to Egypt together before he passed away, before he got sick. And, yeah, he liked to go to different places. And there was a lot of places that, you know, he obviously couldn't go to because, you know, go to Home Depot and get followed around the store all the time. But, you know, he loved to new interesting places. He loved to go to England and go to castles and look at all the old times and things that happened. And as I said, he always wanted to go to Egypt.
Yeah, and so he liked to travel then?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and did you go with him a lot?
Yeah. But when he was home, mostly from the tour when he was home, I mean, we would sort of spurt off on the tour and go to different places. When he was actually home between tours and stuff, he would rather stay home and just have a few friends over, play with his animals, watch sports, you know, just be a new normal person.
And what was his sports of choice? You mentioned baseball. Is that like his sport?
Baseball and football. Giants and Yankees, those are his team. And boy, oh boy, if they lost or somebody did a wrong goal, we would hear it up the street. He was screaming so loud.
I blanked on what I was thinking about here. No, with sports. Oh, did you guys have a house in Cortland?
His parents had a house in Cortland.
Okay, but you guys.
Yeah, you guys. We were in LA, but okay. Yeah. We used to go there a lot and see his parents, and we'd go back and see them. We had his 60th birthday there, actually. There were so many people we ended up having in the street.
And do they have some sort of. They have to have some sort of plaque remembrance or statue or something in Cortland, don't they?
They have a street named after him, Dio Way.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah, I got to get out there. People don't realize that's one of the most beautiful parts of the country as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah. Especially the Lake District around there as well. Really lovely. Yeah.
Well, listen, Wendy, we'll wrap things up here. I got to get a hold of this book for sure. Like I said, I apologize for not having a chance to dig into it, but the excerpt I read was really cool. See, I was and still am a huge fan. And, man, Ronnie's got a couple great IDs we still play here on the radio station. And, you know, it's just, I just smile when I think about that guy, because even though I only met him once for 10 or 15 minutes, I never forgot that. And it was 1994, and it was the only time I'd ever taken all of my CD inserts to the show, and he signed every single one of them. I've never done that before. I didn't do that before, and I've never done it after. I don't know why. I just took them all there, and he signed all of them to me and personalized them, and he was so nice.
Yeah, he was. He was a special person. They broke the mold, I think, when he passed away.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Wendy, good luck with the book. I really appreciate the time.
And thank you so much for your support. We appreciate that. Couldn't do it without you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I was a huge Ronnie James Dio fan growing up. Still am, as a matter of fact. I remember one of the first concerts I saw in my life was Ronnie James Dio. I want to say 85, 86, something along those lines. It was the Sacred Heart Tour, if my memory serves me. And I'll never forget watching Ronnie stab the heart of this dragon on stage. It was pretty cool. And, of course, the dragon like kind of wilted over like a flower that didn't have any water or something. But it was really cool. A great visual. Of course, Ronnie just, you know, like she said, 5 foot four and a half or something like that. Just larger than life. Just towering vocals. And like I said, one of the nicest guys I ever had a chance to meet really early on in my career. And, you know, you're meeting, you know, this guy who's like, you know, a hero of yours, an idol, and he couldn't have been nicer. And I never forgot about that. So got to thank Wendy for her time.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
All right, time to turn our attention to Michael Jantz from the band Richrath Project 313. It's the honoring the legendary Gary Richrath, of course, who was in REO Speedwagon, who we lost in 2015. The new record is out right now. It's called LA Is Mine. And I wanted to ask him where he was calling from right off the get-go, because he told me he was in Southern California.
I'm in Thousand Oaks, which is in Ventura County, okay. North of Los Angeles.
And the reason I ask is because LA Is Mine is the name of the record. And are you a huge fan of Los Angeles, as the song states?
Yes, I am, definitely. This is my second home.
Now, where was your first home? Like, where'd you grow up?
Right outside of Milwaukee.
Okay, so how does a kid from Milwaukee, because I'm not a fan of Los Angeles at all. So I was wondering when I heard that song, I'm like, how does a kid from Milwaukee fall in love with Los Angeles?
Well, like in 1985, I pursued my dream to come out to Los Angeles and try to make it in the music industry. And I moved into not L.A., but, you know, obviously you come out here and we did the whole scene, you know, in the Sunset Boulevard scene. But we actually settled in a town called Thousand Oaks, California, which is it's north of the L.A. area. And it's a beautiful place. It's a lot like where I grew up, but it doesn't have snow and it's got a lot of palm trees.
So it's just like it, but without the snow and the palm trees. Right. Exactly. Yeah. But you come from
every day.
Yeah, right. You come from the home of Harley Davidson. I mean, that's like, you know, close to my heart. So,
yeah, that we do. Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's that would be a part of the first album, the Outlaws song that we have on there too. So we have a lot of history with the Midwest, you know. And like I said, that was part of Gary too. You know, that grassroots rock and roll stuff that we had in the Midwest, we all had that.
So before we get into the new record and the project and the whole thing, so you go to Los Angeles in 1985, and of mm-hmm. course, I mean, obviously the scene is huge at that time. So you were trying to hop into a band, or did you have a band? What was the story?
We had a band, and actually we came from the Midwest and moved out there. We did a small tour with a band called Badfinger, if anybody remembers Badfinger.
Yeah.
And I had a friend that put us on that tour as an opening act on the East Coast. And we did really well, and that was like 1983. And then we started playing a lot in the Midwest, just doing our own stuff. And we decided, let's take a shot for L.A. And we went out to Los Angeles and kind of settled in here to Thousand Oaks and just started, you know, pushing the boulder up the hill out here trying to make it. And it was really difficult. I mean, it was really hard. I mean, all the competition for the bands that were there, you know, like everybody from, you know, the Motley Crue to Rat and all those bands were all doing the same thing we were doing. And it was a great time. It was a great time in my life, but it wasn't until we actually stumbled across Gary Richrath, and he was in the process of leaving REO, and we got together and started working on some material, and lo and behold, how many years later, I'm still doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, aren't we all? How many more years later? But so let me ask you about the band here first in the 80s before we get into the stuff with Gary and that. So you get out there, and you say that your stuff that you were doing at the time was similar to a Rat and Motley Crue and stuff like that?
Well, we were, I guess, one of those, what you call a hair bands or glam bands or whatever. We tried to fit in there, but we didn't really fit in that situation. We were actually a three-piece progressive rock band from the Midwest. But, you know, to make ends meet, you had to do all the covers and stuff like that. So we could either be a cover band in the Midwest or we could go out and try to hit the big time and try to do originals. And we'd play like, you know, Gazzari's or the Roxy or the Whiskey, and we'd play those places. And, you know, every band's playing the same thing. So we'd once in a while throw in a Rush song, and everyone goes, "Oh, my gosh, where are these guys from? They're playing Rush."
Yeah.
But So that was a way that we got some attention with people. But, you know, it didn't really go. We did some showcases with record companies and we did some things like that, but it never really launched, you know. And so we just through this time period is when we met Gary. And Gary kind of took me under his wing and asked me to do some stuff with him. And I put down my bass guitar and started playing rhythm guitar, acoustic guitar, which he wanted me to do for my vocals. You know, taught me some things, and I started singing with him.
All right, so before we get into that, I'm fascinated with this 1980s story because I've talked to a lot of 80s rock bands, and we've talked a lot about the different things. And I grew up in the 1980s. I graduated high school in the mid 80s and stuff like that. So I was kind of like in that era, but I obviously never went to Los Angeles. But so you go out there. How do you try to set yourself apart from all the other bands? Because at the time there was like a flood of bands. Some of them breaking, some of them not. Was there anything that you tried to do, or was that kind of like the thing you tried? You had to try to separate yourself, but you just couldn't, or how does that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, I was telling stories about that just recently. You walked out on a Friday and a Saturday night, you'd go down Sunset Boulevard, and it was just chaotic, mass amounts of people. And back in those days, you could get booked in a show, like at one of the places I said, like the Gazzari's or Rocks or Whiskey or whatever, Troubadour, and you'd have to get posters up, and you'd take these posters and you'd post them up at all the telephone poles and say, "Come out and see this band," you know, and then you'd sell tickets to these shows, and everybody was doing the same thing. I mean, everybody wanted to be the next Poison, you know, everybody wanted to be the next Motley Crue. So that everybody was looking exactly the same, dressing the same way, doing the same thing, and it seemed like there's only going to be a few of them, right? And that's how it worked. And there was only a few of them signed, and we got to constantly keep on changing and keeping yourself, you know, different, but yet still the same. And, you know, we did that for, you know, a couple of years, and it just was getting nowhere. And up until we ran into, like I said, working with Gary, who was already an established rocker. And thank God for that. He took me under his wing, and, you know, things led to something else. So, but, yeah, it was really a difficult business at that time.
So, obviously, you know, you've seen the decline of the Western civilization. It was just like that, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Exactly. It was pretty much just like that, yeah. Except the thing is, I didn't live in Hollywood.
Okay.
I lived in Thousand Oaks. So, like I said, there was a big difference there, you know. I mean, yeah, that's the epitome of the lifestyle there.
All right, final thing for you in the 80s, because this is fascinating. But, like, who were some of your friends or some of the people that you rolled with that we might know from that period?
Well, you know, it was like I came out here from the Midwest. So we didn't really have a lot of friends that we hung out with here because we were actually a different kind of band, but we still tried to fit in. So we would go do these, and being from the Midwest obviously opened a lot of doors because a lot of those people that were in the Hollywood scene, they didn't want to deal with a lot of those people. So we had friends like the one who introduced us to Atlantic Records was Tony Kaye from Yes. Mm. He was actually playing keyboards for Badfinger when we toured on the East Coast with them, and he called up one of the A&R coordinators and said, "Hey, why don't you give these guys a shot? They got some really good material." And so he hooked us up with Atlantic Records, and we did a couple of showcases. We met some agents and managers out here that tried to help us out, some studios where we got to do a bunch of demos. And like I said, it really was just kind of beating the bush, trying to do whatever you can to survive and make ends meet. And then eventually we ended up working with Gary, which was, he already at that time, I think, sold over 23 million records. So he wasn't bad company to hang with.
No, he wasn't. There was a band back in the early 90s, and you may or may not remember them, but I've talked about this a few times, but they were called Nevada Beach, and the reason they were called Nevada Beach was because their thought was that there were so many rock bands in California that the California is going to sink right into the ocean. There's going to be a Nevada Beach. It was kind of like a play on words, right. But just a little bit of hyperbole, yeah. I suppose. But so,
yeah, well, I've heard that story before. I haven't heard of the band, but that's a good idea.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So where do you meet Gary then? Well, how does this work?
Well, we actually met Gary at believe it or not, at just like a convenience store. My drummer was actually working at a convenience store, and Gary came in, and he said, "Hey, you're Gary Richrath from Mario Speedwagon." And he said, "Yes, I am." He says, "You look like you must play, you play in a band." And he said, "Yeah." He goes, "Let's jam sometime." So, he said that, and he came home, and he was excited and said, "Hey, I just met Gary Richrath." I'm like, "Yeah, right. Okay, sure." And everybody was like, it didn't really happen, but it did. And then about a month later, he knocked on our door and came over and started jamming with us. So
that's crazy, especially back then without the internet, without cell phones, without anything. That's wild.
I know. I actually thought about that the other day. I'm like, well, I can't remember the cell number. I mean, like, how did you call? And it's just regular landlines, It's just like, and I remember, at that time, everybody just talked on regular landlines.
Right. Yeah, but it's weird. Gary Richrath, like you said, a bona fide, rock superstar, walks into a convenience store. Next thing you know, he's jamming with the clerk.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened, though. And seriously, it was funny because, I remember the first time when he asked me, after the first couple of sessions, he came and sat in with us when we played at the Roxy. And he came up and we did Ride in the Storm out, and we did another song, and then we did one of my songs. Can you imagine that? I mean, that brought in people. So,
right.
And that whole crowd of people started liking us more, a lot quicker. And then he did a show with us at Gazzari's, and Gazzari's is no longer there, but that was a pretty popular place. I've heard the stories of Van Halen, was their early days there at Gazzari's.
Yeah, right.
That was a trip. That place was a trip,
Yeah, that was in Decline of the Western Civilization as well, I do believe.
Yeah,
they were doing
he was in there too. He was the owner, and the guy was like way old, and he always had like really young, hot looking women around him constantly. And it was just bizarre. He always wore a suit and a hat. And he'd come walking on it was bizarre world out here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did that, and then next thing we just started working on songs. And I first went up to his house, and he had a home studio, and I went into his house, and there's like gold and platinum records. Talk about intimidation,
Yeah, and talk about a pretty nice house.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. Yeah, nicer than what I had, that's for sure.
And so now I was just talking with Wendy Dio about this, but you guys start writing music and stuff, and then all of a sudden this thing starts happening out of the, in the fall of 1991 called grunge. Did you guys, what was your thoughts on that? Or did you guys just keep on doing what you were doing?
We just kept doing what we were doing, but that's funny. If you just talk with, Niji Management, I actually did some things with them at the country club in Reseda. There was a guy that was working with them that was looking at us to sign us, and I didn't even know at the time who she was, but not through the years I found out Ronnie James Dio. But that's a very interesting name. I haven't heard her name in a long time. So.
Yeah, they got the new book out. I just talked to her a little while ago. But the new Ronnie James Dio book came out a couple weeks back. So you guys record this record and stuff. And first of all, kind of refresh my memory. Why did Gary leave REO? What was the deal there?
Well, I mean, like I said, again, there's all kinds of speculation of what was going on, and it was, who really knows the truth, but, what happened with the people that were involved. But, I was around a lot. At one point in time, we were doing demos with the band, and then I got asked to do some lead vocals with my drummer. And so I don't know. I mean, really, there's all kinds of speculation, but the bottom line of it is that, Gary went in a different direction, and
yeah,
Kevin went in his direction. And all that matters is right now that we're still doing what we're doing, and I'm still trying to spread the Richrath word out there, because he was the guitar player that should have been he's the sound of REO, in my opinion. So,
by the way, have you watched that series Ozark on Netflix?
No, I haven't. I heard about them being on there, but I've never watched it.
Yeah, it is. The show's not very funny. It's like a drama, you know. But there was a hysterical scene when this guy wants REO to play, and I think at one point he may even call him the wagon. Although I'm not sure, but I can't recall. But anyways, it was really funny. I had to watch it a couple times. So Gary's just kind of doing his thing then through the '90s and the early 2000s. Is that kind of what happens?
Yeah, pretty much his own thing. We had a deal with Crescendo Records, which is out of Hollywood, and we put out an album. We toured constantly. We were constantly on the road, and we were working on new demos. And eventually, what happened was is after he passed away, we got back together a couple times to work on a second Rich Rath album, and it just was too difficult at that time.
And what year are we talking about here? Like 13, 14?
No, actually before that. Okay. It was I stopped working with him after the 2001 era. And then he was in the back in the Midwest trying to do some things with some other people in the Midwest, but it never amounted to anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I had worked with him in my place out in Wisconsin and his place back in California several times prior to 2000, and then we were going to do another album at the end of 2000. It just didn't pan out. So after he passed away, the record company came to me and asked me if I'd consider putting out some of these other songs and do like some stuff from the past. And I said, well, you know, I had to think about it. And then they kind of got me to do it. And the COVID hit. And so we decided to put it on hold again. And another label came to me and said, let's get this thing done and let's get it out there. Dark Star, you know, is the ones who finished the album for us. And we put it out there and we used demos that I had and stuff that Gary and I put together, and then new songs, and we did a cover of Riding the Storm Out and Son of a Poor Man in the 70s, and we did the 70s version. So it's definitely a Gary Richrath rocker, you know?
Yeah,
in his era.
Yeah, so when was the last time you talked to Gary?
Years ago. I mean, years ago. I mean, he passed away in 2015. It probably was 2001, maybe.
Okay, that's what I thought. Like so it says in the bio here that you guys were working together, and you guys would, you know, punch out at like 3:13 in the morning. I'm assuming that's what that meant. And then, but then after a while, you guys just decided to go your own separate ways. What exactly happened?
Well, there were different reasons. We just basically kind of didn't want to. He was in L.A., I was in Wisconsin, and we just didn't see eye to eye in a lot of things. And it was getting to the point where I was kind of taking a break on the whole music business for a while. And I was going in a different direction with what I wanted to do. And then, he went his way. I went my way. And then I lost track of him for a while. And then I heard he moved back to Peoria. So he lived back in Peoria after all the years in California. And that was about it. And then I heard he passed away. And that was very sad for me. But, I wanted to have my memories of him the way that I had it, and that was, this is one of the reasons why I put out this album.
Now, do you have to contact family or management or whatever to use his name or some of his songs or some of his even some of his riffs and stuff?
No, I don't have to. All my stuff is I owned all the masters for everything that I've done. So there was no I have the name all copyrighted, and everything is the way it is with Project 313, and it was a time period that we had, so there was nothing I needed to do at that point.
Mm-hmm. And so how many tracks is Gary on it? Did I read correctly, like three or four, or is there more?
There's three tracks.
Three tracks, okay. And so he's got some guitar stuff on there, obviously. And did I read right, some backing vocals or something in some of them?
There are some backing vocals on there too. Yes.
Yeah. So what was it like revisiting some of this stuff?
Well, it was, how do you say, it was interesting because some of the stuff we were going to put out together and some of the stuff we decided to put on hold for a while from after the first album, some of the stuff we came back and you know, I have quite a bit of stuff, actually. There's stuff that I still have that I haven't released yet. So there's been a lot of stuff through the years that we've put together that we both had access to. So I have no idea where his stuff went to, and I don't you know, I don't really research that thing, but I have my stuff and I know what I'm able to do. So
must have brought back a bunch of memories and kind of put you back in a time period 20 years ago or whenever it was, right?
Yeah, it was, it's like I said, some of it's real good and some of it, you know, you have to go, okay, I remember when this happened. And, you know, we had, all I can say, it was a lot of fun. We had a great time together. I loved it. I wouldn't change it for the world. And again, I think his calling was missed. You know, he was the sound of REO, and that's all I can say about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The sound of
a good guy.
a good guy. Yeah. Yeah. And a great talent. And of course, like I was just going to say, it's like the sound of roller skating rinks all across North America in the early 80s.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So then, like you said, he passes away in 2015. And then you start to kind of get this project coming back together. And then COVID hits last year and stuff. So then you put it back together. Now, how do you put the band together, this particular band right here? Or was this kind of were these the guys with all the time?
No, I've changed the members several times, but I worked with a keyboard player since the early 2000s, and then the guitar player he was with me for the early 2000s, and then did a different project. And you know, it's just the typical thing. There's bands, guys come and go, but it was always basically the same setup as the original Rich Raff band. You know, I mean, it was the same kind of, you know, guitar, bass, drums, and keyboards. And vocals, so we based it the same way. It's hard to change it after that.
Yeah, yeah. I like to ask people like yourself that have gone through, you know, and done this business for a long time in different bands, different things like that. Was there any other bands that you auditioned for or tried out for, or maybe had requests to come by and jam with throughout your career?
Well, I'm sure there has been. I mean, I've worked with so many different people through the years. I mean, like I said, from being on the road with so many different bands, when I was touring with Gary, we played with everybody. But I mean, auditioning with people, I've had a lot of people audition for this band. I can't even begin to tell you how many. So, but for myself, I haven't really done it to audition for other people because I've always been kind of in charge of this project I'm doing. So, you know, and I took a ticket from one format to another format. And like I said, this last time that we did it was, Dark Star Records took over, and they wanted to finish this up, and that's how we ended up.
Well, the record is out today, Rich Raff Project. Is it 313, or how do you pronounce that?
It's Rich Raff Project 313.
Okay.
And it's LA is mine, and it's streaming everywhere, and you can get it just about everywhere today. We have a video that came out a couple weeks ago for the single Help Me Save Me For Myself. Which is a song that Gary wrote.
That's an interesting song. And, yeah.
Well, I think it says it's, you know, like you kind of were asking some questions, and that's pretty much what it sums it all up to me, you know. And, and the guy, you know, guy was a dear friend of mine, and, you know, through the years, it is what it is. And I think a lot of people can figure that out. And there was there's a lot of problems there with a lot of people, and especially in this day and age, you know. So there's a lot of people that don't know how to get the help they need, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, in the industry too.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. You know, just everywhere. It's just the world sometimes is not a real positive place, and hopefully this song will bring some positive thoughts to everybody.
Well, you're going to be touring. Of course, you're coming through the Motor City at one of my favorite places, the Token Lounge, coming up on August 29th. We'll throw that information out there for everybody, and that should be fun. And I'll tell you what, this record, it does have that REO sound, but of course, obviously, there's, you know, it's not REO, but you do cover the one REO song, like you said.
Right. Well, we actually have two REO songs on there.
Oh, the two, okay.
And Reitner Starmount. Yeah.
All right,
and,
okay.
Yeah, and those are songs that, like I said, I worked extensively with Gary. He wanted me to do those songs through the years when I played with them. We did them live. And I've noticed that there's another band out there called REO Speedwagon that's put the Son of a Poor Man back in there, and they're doing it more and more all the time. So it's kind of interesting. But, you know, that's one of those things. It's about his wife. And Help Me Save Me For Myself is another one. With it's got my vocals on it that I do extensive vocal work on this stuff, and that's one of the reasons why Gary wanted to work with me. And I think people will just love it, you know, and they can get it anywhere.
Right.
Well, that's a good thing.
That is a good thing compared to in the 80s when he moved out to Los Angeles.
Yes. Well, it was good things from the original stuff we did. It was real hard back in those days. The streaming thing and all the internet stuff really helped us out a lot getting it out there.
Yeah. So. Well, Michael, thank you so much for the time. LA Is Mine is the new record. And like I said, August 29th here at the Token. So safe travels, and we'll see you out there.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Michael Jansen, Wendy Dio today on the Talk It Rock with Meltdown podcast. That's an interesting project right there. You know, the music of REO, Gary Richrath, legendary, right? And that Ozark scene is so funny, by the way. If you've seen it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But that series is kind of, you know, it's kind of serious for the most part. And then they throw in this The Wagon comment or whatever it was. But anyhow, that record is out. LA Is Mine. If you're a fan of the REO Speedwagon type of thing, definitely check out this album because it is right in your wheelhouse. In the meantime, I'm Meltdown. Thank you so much for checking out the podcast. We'll do it all over again real soon. Going to check out a couple bands this weekend. Three Doors Down in Seether tomorrow. Guns N' Roses on Sunday. We've got Green Day going to be playing in town coming up on Tuesday. I was thinking about heading to Mid-Michigan tonight for Shinedown and Theory of a Dead Man and Pop Evil as well, but don't think I'm going to be making that one. So anyways, yeah, hit me up if you want on my socials at Meltdown, WRIF. It's a WRIF Meltdown on my Instagram. And if you want to, you know, get in contact with me, you can email me as well at Meltdown, WRIF. As always, thanks so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. You can help this podcast grow by giving it a 5-star rating and writing a review on Apple and iTunes. Plus, feel free to subscribe and share it with your friends. Until next time, thanks for listening to Talkin' Rock.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.